Joe Biden has lived up to expectations. He swore that if elected president, he would reverse everything Trump had accomplished. He then followed through with a frantic rush of executive orders that have placed us back in the Paris Accords, and he's now making it clear that he wants more talks with Iran. Like Barack Hussein Obama before him, Biden is toying with a bailout for Iran, the greatest supporter of terrorism in our world. Trump had placed sanctions against Iran that had brought their economy to its knees. Biden is going to put them back into business. Iran's spokesperson said that they might agree to talks, but only if they are the superior party in those talks. If we survive the Biden administration, it will take decades to undo the harm they are causing. Now, Democrats are revising the issue of reparations. Biden will cater to it because he sees it as a sure vote for Democrats. I share credit for today's commentary with Adolph Reed, Jr. and Herschel Walker for their contributions. I'm going to discuss the idea of reparations, which has been brought up again in Congress. But before I begin, I would point to the demonization of white people that is spreading across our country, and it's dangerous. We are being told to make ourselves less white. Coca-Cola is under fire for issuing that directive to its employees, but they are far from alone on the subject. While it is racist to condemn the entire black population for the words or actions of a minority of them, it is equally racist to condemn the entire white community for the words and actions of a minority of whites. Contrary to what we are hearing about white people are the facts. Yes, there are white supremacists in our country, but they are a small, radical group. But it cannot be ignored that there is a small minority of people with black skins who are equally radical. This attack against white America is gaining steam, and it's just another way to divide and conquer us. Our enemies are not all across the ocean. We have plenty of them right here. They're called progressives. Ironically, it is white progressives leading the call to condemn whites. They either have no mirrors or they are as ignorant as charged. As a white man, I have every right to be angry at those who attack the color of my skin. Having a white or black skin does not define us as human beings. What is accomplished by this continuing division among us? How can we continue as the world's greatest power when we are no longer the United States of America? The Democrat Party has been at the forefront of this division for the races. They don't see people, they see votes. Whatever it takes to gain those votes, they're willing to do. It is true that the United States has a racist past, but great strides have been made to correct it, unlike other countries, especially Africa. I'll be the first to say that slavery was abominable, but I had no hand in that. As far as I can research, my family tree has no slave owners in it. As a person with a white skin, I can't help what was done more than 150 years ago. I can condemn it, and I do. But I am no more responsible for slavery than a black person is responsible for slavery by their ancestors in Africa, slavery that continues even to this day. The continuing drumbeat against white people grows louder. There is little being done to curtail it because white America has been cowed into silence. Speak up against this injustice and you'll be called a racist. But I will not be silenced. I will stand with black people when they are right, and I will stand with white people when they are in the right. What I will not do is remain quiet while the crescendo builds against an entire race of people based on the color of the skin God gave them. Black or white, they are precious in His sight. And the sooner we accept that and reach out to each other, the sooner this nation will heal itself. Reparations are coming back like a bad tuna sandwich. The notion that white America, however defined, owes reparations to black Americans for slavery and its legacy has been around for decades. Until recently, its most dramatic eruption into public life was in 1969 when James Forman, the former chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, led a protest at New York's liberal Riverside Church and presented a black manifesto that demanded, among other things, $500 million in reparations to black Americans from white churches and synagogues. That idea lingered on the periphery of the public agenda for a few years. In 1972, Jesse Jackson's operation, PUSH, and the National Economics Association, a black economist group, attempted to reintroduce it around the presidential election in conjunction with a demand that had increased now to $900 million as a freedom budget. For the next four decades, the idea of organizing to demand reparations circulated mainly within politically marginal nationalist circles. It did not gain much traction, even among black activists. During the last half dozen years or so, however, the issue has been threatening to come in from the margins. Partly stimulated by the successful pursuit of compensation for Japanese Americans who were interned by the U.S. government during World War II and for victims of Nazi slave labor, talk of a movement to demand reparations for black Americans began to spread again. We've all watched this with curiosity and bemusement. We imagined the reparations talk would evaporate because it seemed so clearly a political dead end, no such luck, as we now have a Biden administration in place where the idea is again germinating. How has this happened, and what is its significance? To put it more provocatively, how could a project that seems so obviously a non-starter in American politics come to capture so much of the public imagination? After all, support for affirmative action has eroded significantly, and reparations raises the ante on compensatory policy exponentially. Why has this idea gained new strength now? Answering these questions requires understanding that the call for reparations blends material, symbolic, and psychological components. The material component is the most obvious, since the call for reparations responds to the actual harm inflicted on blacks during and after slavery. This component includes direct legacies, such as the federal government's failure to fulfill the promise of emancipation by adopting the radical Republican proposals during Reconstruction. That would have expropriated the plantations in the South and divided them among the free people, thus establishing a black group of independent stakeholders. Democrats blocked that move and insisted on keeping slavery alive. It also includes the federal government's further capitulation to the former slaveholders by accepting their disenfranchisement of black voters later in the 19th and early 20th centuries. As a result, black citizens were removed from effective participation in public life. What followed was the imposition of the white supremacist regime of official and economic apartheid that reigned in the South for the first two-thirds of the 20th century. The indirect material legacy of slavery includes such explicitly discriminatory practices as the Federal Housing Administration's enforcement of racially exclusionary restrictive covenants in its lending policies, officially until 1948, and unofficially for some years thereafter. This practice severely disadvantaged black people's pursuit of home ownership, the principal form of capital accumulation for most Americans. No sane person can dispute the fact that slavery was an abomination. The effects of unequal education, labor market discrimination, and publicly initiated and supported ghettoization and further indirect material legacies of slavery. We could also include the effects of the New Deal compromises with Southern Democrats, largely racially inspired, that excluded most black workers from initial coverage under Social Security and agricultural assistance. That is all true. And truth be told, if any reparations are to be paid, it should come from the Democrat Party, since it was they who fought against ending slavery. That blacks have been systematically disadvantaged as a result of slavery and its aftermath, there can be no doubt. That is the strength of the material case for reparations. The symbolic component of reparations seems to center on public acknowledgement of the injustices inflicted on black people historically in this country. On the one hand, this could promote public education about the real history of the United States, although that is a project that does not require the rhetorical reparations argument. On the other hand, it fits the Clintonoid and Obama tenor of sappy public apologies and maudlin psychobabble about collective pain and healing. Some seem fixated on pursuing racial parity in monuments and statuary. Elites will always prefer symbolic gestures to material ones. The psychological components, though, is the most revealing of the dubious politics that undergirds this movement. The demand for reparations is held to be important as a means of raising consciousness among black people, whether or not it can be won. But consciousness of what? Among most populists of radical adherence, this view persists on the premise, a vestige of nationalist, anti-imperialist radicalism that evolved from black power, that mobilizing black people to fight for a better world requires first rectifying their understanding of who they are and where they come from in order to build on the principle of racial solidarity. Of course, cultivation of general understanding of history is useful, perhaps even necessary, for developing and sustaining an insurgent politic. And it's a good thing in its own right. However, it's more than questionable that people must or even will mobilize around earlier generations' grievances to pursue current objectives. The deeper appeal of reparations talk for its proponents is to create or stress a sense of racial peoplehood as the primary basis for political identity. This movement's psychological project is grounded in two beliefs. First, that rank-and-file black people suffer from an improper or defective sense of identity. And second, that an important task of political action is to restore or correct racial consciousness that the legacy of slavery is supposed to have distorted or destroyed. Among other strains of cultural nationalists, this view unabashedly reproduces the old damage theses, which was criticized by historian Darrell Michael Scott in his book Contempt and Pity, Social Policy and the Image of Damaged Black Psyche. According to this thesis, slavery and its aftermath left black Americans without cultural moorings and therefore especially vulnerable to various social pathologies. This notion has been the foundation of academic and journalistic slanders of black, poor, and working people. It was famously perpetrated by Daniel Patrick Moynihan in his 1965 report, The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, and it underlines contemporary notions of a self-destructive black urban underclass. The argument for pursuit of reparations hinges on this view of the black American population. But the question of compensations opens a plethora of technical problems. Should payments go to individuals or to some presumably representative corporate entity? If the former, who qualifies as a recipient? Would descendants of people who had been enslaved elsewhere, for instance, Brazil or the Caribbean, be eligible? And what of those no longer legally black people with slave ancestors? These issues could provide a lively trade for genealogists, DNA testers, and other quacks, and already seem to be rising to the opportunity. These ambiguities, moreover, expose the faultiness of comparisons to payments to victims of Japanese internment in Nazi slave labor camps. They were identifiable individuals whose experience of the ultimate justice was direct. If the recipient is to be some corporate entity, how can its representatives and accountability be determined? If the body is a developmental fund, who would control it, and how would the decisions be made? Some have suggested that philanthropic agencies be the guarantees. But to which ones, and to whom would they be accountable? This talk, as is standard in contemporary black politics, presumes a coherent, knowable black agenda that can be determined outside of democratic participatory processes among those in whose names decisions are to be made and resources allocated. History has shown that someone like Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton always wind up with the lion's share in any such programs. But the question ultimately does not arise because reparations talk is rooted in a different kind of politics, a politics of elite brokerage and entity to the ruling class and official conscience. The philanthropic foundations for racial side payments, the beef, is strong. The beef is that black Americans are statistically overrepresented at the bottom. This is a protest politics that depends on the goodwill of those who hold power. By definition, it is not equipped to challenge existing relations of power and distribution other than marginally with token gestures. Reparations are an ethical disaster for this country. Proceeding from a doctrine of collective guilt, they are the penalty for slavery and Jim Crow, sins of which no living Americans stand accused. An offense against common sense, as well as morality, reparations would take from Bubba and give to Barack. Never mind if the former is an insolvent meth addict or the latter a dweller near pharaonic splendor. That reparations are a hopeless cause, supported by only a quarter of Americans, makes them more of an affront to reason than less, for it illustrates the enthusiasm with which Democrat politicians will bang their heads against the wall in an attempt to purchase votes. Even in pragmatic terms, reparations fail. The real-world difficulties that would attend such payments are obvious enough to suggest that the sudden new support for reparations amounts to little more than pandering. These difficulties are so extraordinarily compelling that nobody wonders how the call for reparations sustains any support at all. Since the money to pay for them would have to be raised alongside the taxes needed to finance Democrats' grandiose spending plans, reparations would totally wreck the economy, sentencing Americans of all races to a future of higher unemployment, slower wage growth, and less entrepreneurship, because potential awardees would have to prove their eligibility in some manner. Reparations would be an invitation to perpetual litigation and would subject America to the spectacle of government officials deciding who counts as black. These are powerful objections, and the case against reparations could easily prevail on their strength alone. Yet they are not the only flaws in the reparations scheme and are, in fact, subordinate to a more fundamental blemish. Even if the practical defects of the project could be overcome, reparations simply would not work. They would not make atonement. They would neither settle nor soothe. In short, they would fulfill none of the promises explicit in the language of their proponents. Like all political ideas, unburdened by their likelihood of actually happening, Reparations are frequently spoken of in outlandish terms. Elizabeth Warren has argued that Native Americans and same-sex couples ought to be given money as well. That such one-upmanship is a regular feature of a political culture that rewards rallying the base and is no surprise. Pay what you owe, proponents suggest, and America can have its soul back. Confess your sin with a large enough check, and you can be forgiven. So will reparations work? To believe that it can, one has to believe that the political apparatus currently pursuing reparations would simply cease to exist upon their being awarded, that no further explanations of the nation's sins would be necessary. For the left, however, reparations are merely the icing on the cake of admissions preferences, minority contracting requirements, and eternally expanding welfare state. And what happens with the black Americans who took advantage of the opportunities afforded to them by America? What is owed to Oprah and Snoop Dogg, Barack Hussein Obama, Denzel Washington, numerous filthy rich black athletes, Robert Johnson of BET Network, and so many others who have prospered in America? Are taxpayers supposed to pay reparations to them? And where does it stop? The reality is that reparations, however generous, would have nothing like the effect promised by those calling for them. Pay them to black Americans today, and you will soon be called to pay them to others. Compensate one generation, and you will confirm your debt to the next. Reparations would not mend us, restore us, or bring us together. They would only further divide, embitter, and impoverish. We can't afford to pay them. We can't even come close to it. But even if we could, we should not. As Herschel Walker pointed out to Congress, both blacks and whites were slave traders. Some black immigrants weren't even here during slavery, nor their ancestors. Some states didn't even allow slavery. Their citizens have to pay too? Walker asked, who is the guilty party? Should we start at the beginning, where Africans sold your African ancestors into slavery? Should Americans, African Americans, here today, be compelled to pay reparations to the families of those Africans that were sold into slavery? No doubt they would argue against paying reparations to Africans because they were not personally involved. That's the same argument white people make when the issue of reparations is raised. This is a can of worms left unopened. Thank you for listening today. I try to research and present issues that would be things the mainstream media will not address. We should all learn lessons from slavery and, frankly, pay some attention to blacks enslaved in Africa even today. Do those black lives not matter? I'll be back again next week, God willing. Same time and same station. And God bless America.